other than himself. So he is called Swashraya. Yeah, Swashraya. He is his own shelter. Anyway, actually, without reading text 60, we have sort of discussed text 60, actually. Shall I just read text 60, or are your minds overloaded? All right, I'll read it. 60.1. It's basically just going to reiterate what I said, I would say, more or less. The verse beginning, Ekam Ekatarabhave 2.10.9, shows how the fact that all of these Purushas are mutually dependent, in effect, means that none of them is the Ashraya. So we said that. The explanation is as follows. Without the presence of the visible object, there is no basis for the existence of either the sense organ, whose presence is inferred from the perception of the object, or the seer. And without the seer, the sun god and other presiding deities of perception also have no basis for existing. Without the presiding deity of sight, the sense of sight cannot act. And without the sense of sight, there can be no perception. Thus, in the absence of any one of the three Purushas, we cannot find either of the others. They all become lost. Such being the case, the one who knows all three of these, perceiving them visually as their witness, namely the Supersoul, is indeed the actual Ashraya or shelter. In refutation of the idea that the three Purushas are shelters for one another. Anyway, we just said that they are kind of shelters, but let us just read on. He's now going to say he's going to refute that idea. The Supersoul is specifically characterized as Swashraya, his own shelter, meaning that he has no other shelter and is consequently the shelter of all others. In this context, the living entity is also called Ashraya, but only in the sense of emphasizing the partial non-difference between the pure jiva and the Supersoul, who are related as part and whole respectively. So it's basically what we have said, more or less. 60.2. The pure jiva is designated as the witness in such statements as, although transcendental, he considers himself a material product. Oh, that's 175 again. One of our old friends amongst the verses. Or waking, awareness, dream and deep sleep are the functions of the mind caused by the modes of material nature. The individual soul has been ascertained to be distinct from these functions as their witness. Bhagavatam 11.13.27. And the pure one witnesses the actions of the impure agent, the mind. Bhagavatam 5.11.12. The pure jiva being characterized thus, it cannot reasonably be proposed that this jiva, known as the witness, is the ashraya, not the ashraya. Alternatively, one might propose that the aspects of adhyatmic and so on are also ashrayas. This is what we were saying. We answer that this is true, but still, since they are dependent on one another, none of them is exclusively the ashraya. As the verse beginning Ekam states, it is not in the direct literal sense that they are referred to as ashrayas. And 60.3. Then let the witness, the jiva, be the shelter. A doubt. Let us say that the jiva is the ashraya. In answer, the words beginning Tritiyam are spoken. The witnessing self, the jiva, is called Swashraya, his own shelter. But, in fact, his ashraya is the Supersoul, who has no other ashraya. This is the difference between the two. Similarly, the Hansaguya prayers, Bhagavatam 6.4.25, say, a person who knows the modes of nature may know everything about them, but he does not know the all-knowing one. I worship that unlimited Lord. Thus, it is that Supersoul, described in such statements as the one beginning, Abhashas Cha, 2.10.7. That was text 58. I think, was it? 58, yeah. That was the introductory verse to the Ashraya. So thus it is the supersoul described in such statements as that one, which is alone the Ashraya. So in this sense, the jiva may be called Swashraya, kind of his own shelter. But the supersoul is also called Swashraya. Well, he is also Ashraya. He is his own shelter, very clearly. The jiva, in a very limited sense, may be Swashraya, in the sense that he is a fragment of the Absolute. If we take the jiva as being, you know, we could possibly utilize this term Swashraya for him, then the supersoul becomes Swashrayashraya. Swashrayashraya. He who is the shelter of everyone, of all shelters, including those who may be sort of their own shelter to some extent, or just that he is the shelter of all shelters and he is his own shelter. How does that sound? Is that okay? So therefore, it is the supersoul, it is the supreme Brahman, because, you know, we're talking about, he refers to 2.10.7 finally, and that is quoted in text 58. And in text 58, he said, Sa'ashraya param Brahma, paramatme ti shabjate. So that Ashraya is the supreme Brahman, it is the supersoul iti, and thus it is also Bhagavan. Yeah. So like this, this is now how Shukadeva Goswami shows us what is the position of that Ashraya, that non-dual consciousness, that absolute consciousness, is that final shelter, is the cause of all causes, the cause of creation, where everything goes when it's wound up, and, you know, what all the manus are related with, where the process of creation is coming from, primary and secondary, and all the maintenance and protection, all the fruit of desires, it's all connected with him. How does that sound? Reasonable? Yeah. Okay. Comments or questions? It's in 60.2. The jiva is... Where is it? He says here... No, it's 60.1, sorry. The last sentence in 60.1. In this context, the living entity, the jiva, is also called Ashraya, but only in the sense of emphasizing the partial non-difference between the pure jiva and the supersoul, who are related as part and whole. Because the jiva is eternal, the body is not eternal. The demigods with their sensory capabilities are not eternal. But now the jiva, it does share certain of these like superior characteristics that the supersoul has. It's eternal, for example. The jiva has his own energy. The jiva is self-existent. So in that sense, he can be considered Swashraya. You know, the material body can be annihilated any time. The demigods can be annihilated any time. But the jiva can never be annihilated. So therefore, the jiva has some sort of limited but still real sheltering capability. Yeah. In that sense. In the sense of existence, in the sense of functioning, the conditioned soul without a body is not really an ashraya, not in a very substantial sense. the consideration, the important fact, we mentioned it, though, I think, of the jiva in his conditioned state is that he has to have a body, otherwise he can't function. He becomes, you know, he'll stop, sort of. Well, because some people may think that the conditioned soul may be the ashraya. They may also think that the body is the ashraya, and the senses, or even the combination of the three, or any two of them, yeah, but they're not. But then, in another sense, when he says that the jiva can be seen as swashraya, his own shelter, then he's looking from a purely spiritual perspective. No, it's not conditioned, it's a purely spiritual. His non-difference, it says it's only in the sense of emphasizing the partial non-difference between the pure jiva and the supersoul. So looking at it from that point of view. Not, because then he's not the adiatmic purusha. He's not the adiatmic purusha. Because adiatmic, that is implying in the conditioned state. Yeah. Otherwise he's just atma. Mm-hmm. There are different annihilations. Actually he's referring here to the end of the day of Brahma and the end of the life of Brahma. Yeah. Yeah. In that sense then, in that sense is the end of the life of Brahma. Yeah, in that sense. But it can include, because it's annihilation, the subject in general is annihilation. So it actually includes all the forms of annihilation, even the partial annihilation at the end of Manu's life, like that. Yeah. But particularly it's that final dissolution. That's how he's describing it there. It's specifically talking in terms... See, demigods, like here, the demigod of the sun is specifically mentioned. He controls sight, but he controls other things also. He controls the heat of this universe. He controls the sun planet. So here we're talking about demigods in a very specific functional sense. Yeah. Now they're also, you know, it is not that because they're demigods, they independently, like the demigod of the sun, it is not that he independently has his own sense of sight. He is also dependent. Yeah. But in terms of the functioning of the universe, he is governing so many living entities in terms of supplying them sight. Or the demigod of the moon. He has a number of functions. One of them is to control the functioning of the mind, which is one of the six senses. So in that sense, in terms of how he's working in that regard, he's being described here. Yeah. As the adidaivik purusha. It's a particular concept. It is not that that is all there is to these demigods. You know, they're also greater. They have other functions than just dealing with our sensory capabilities. Talked about the body as being a purusha. Was it in 59.1? Yeah, 59.1. The last paragraph of 59.2. The last paragraph. He says, this physical body is said to be a person because it is an upadhi superimposed upon the real person, the jiva. Yeah. So it's in that sense. The body's not just a lump of matter. But in this sense, we're talking in a certain sense here. Yeah. We're talking about demigods in a certain sense. Not, you know, completely how they are as demigods. but how they're functioning as these functional entities, adi-atmic, adi-bhotic. We're talking about the jiva also, in a certain sense, adi-atmic in that sense. Then they're, you know, to like get it clear exactly what we're talking about, then we refer to them as being Purushas, as persons. But it means an entity of a specific makeup, specific nature. If the jiva, when it comes to that time of dissolution, when it comes to the time of dissolution, if some of the jivas are qualified, they go back to Godhead. So we know this is all actually in the context of Lord Brahma speaking to Narada, and then the Lord speaking to Lord Brahma. When Narada asks Lord Brahma, "Are you the Supreme Person?" Brahma says, "No," and then explains how the Lord spoke Srimad Bhagavatam to him. So this is all following on from that. So it's kind of in the context of Lord Brahma and his position and what he goes through. So therefore the mentioning here is in terms of his experience and his associates. Okay, I think we should end here. And tomorrow we'll read the last section. We're there.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So today we will endeavor to complete the text of Tattva Sandarbha, and then we'll run through the test, and my idea actually is to do the test tomorrow. How does that sound? I won't be here now on page 83, and we have our last little subsection. This is all to do, of course, with defining the meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam, in this case in reference to the descriptions given in the Bhagavatam of its 10 topics and how its 10 topics are addressed and described like that. So yesterday we were discussing how Shukadeva Goswami, how he presents the 10 topics. That was in the second canto, chapter 10. Now in the 12th canto, chapter 7, is it? I think it's 7. Yeah, it is. 12th canto, chapter 7, that means right at the end of the book, Suta Goswami also lists out the 10 topics. But actually, at least on the surface of it, he does that a little differently. And we have indicated that by what we've written on the board there. On your left-hand side is the list that we went through yesterday in the order given yesterday by Shukadeva Goswami in the second canto. On your right-hand side is, well, actually, I need to, in fact, just change it or add something, in fact, to suttas, because suttas' order is different in some cases, and the names are different in some cases. Yeah, let me just quickly write it on. Here you have the lists. Shukadev, as we discussed yesterday, number one is Sarga. The parallel from Sutta is also Sarga, exactly the same. It's also number one in Sutta's list from the 12th canto. Then, second, also in both cases, is Visarga, the secondary creation. And similarly, third, well, they use different terms. Shukadev says Stanam. He also said sthiti, in one of those verses that was following on and just giving some further explanation, he said, Stiti Vaikuntha Vijaya. Yeah. So, Stanam or Stiti is given by Sugadevas number 3, means maintenance or protection like that. And Sutta, though, his number 3, which means exactly the same thing, is Vritti. V-R with a dot under the R, T-T-I. Then they both have the same, using different terms though, for number 4. Poshana. Shukadev says Poshana is number 4. Protecting the devotees. Sutta says Raksha. It's just a difference in word. And in both cases, it's number 4. Shukadev, his number 5 is Uti, material desires. And Sutta, he uses the word Hetu, but actually it's number 9 in his list. Then, number 6 from Shukadev is Manvantara. You know, we would tend to place a little more emphasis on Shukadev's because he is really the celebrated speaker. But actually there's no real difference that we'll see as we go through them. So number 6 from Shukadeva is Manvantara, the lifetimes of the Manus and other rulers and saints even. Sutta calls that Antara, and for him it's number 5 and not number 6. Number 7 from Shukadeva is Ishanukata. Ishanukata means stories about the Lord, about the great devotees. Sutta said his number 6 and number 7 are Vangsa and Vangsa Anucharita, which anyway, we'll read about that shortly, very shortly. Vangsa means the dynasties of great kings, and Vangsa Anucharita means the activities of those kings. Yeah. One is just descriptive, or description of the dynasty. And you see that if you read the Bhagavatam. There are a few chapters, they just list out names. Who was who, and who was their son, and then who was his children, and so on like that. Then Vangsa Anucharita, number 7 from Sutta, means the activities of those kings. Then Nirodha, number 8 from Shukadev, means annihilation. So it is also number 8 from Sutta, but it's called Samsta. Then Shukadev's number 9 is Mukti, liberation. That is included within annihilation. It is a particular form of annihilation. When we get to number 6, verse 63, we'll see that very clearly. So that is there. It is kind of featuring as 2 in Sutta's list. Then number 10, of course, from Shukadev is the Ashraya. And Sutta, it's also number 10, but he calls it Apashraya. It means basically the same thing. This list is given by Sridhar Swami in his Bhavartha Deepika. All right. So, we'll start reading 61.1. In the following 2 verses, Sri Sudha Goswami describes in a different way the characteristics of Srimad Bhagavatam that qualify it as a Mahapurana. And in so doing, he affirms that the Supreme Lord alone is the Ashraya. So as we said, this is Srimad Bhagavatam, 12th canto, chapter 7, beginning with verse 9. And again, it's a whole series of verses. First of all, these two verses, 9 and 10, they just list out the 10 topics. Then the following so many verses explain them. And then a final 2 or 3 or so verses explain the 10th one, the Apashraya, according to Sutta. So, Sutta then says in 12.7, 9 and 10, O Brahman, authorities on the matter understand a Purana, because he means here a Mahapurana, to contain 10 characteristic topics. Sarga, the creation of this universe. Visarga, the subsequent creation of worlds and beings. Vritti, the maintenance of all living beings. Raksha, the sustenance of all living beings. Antarani, the rule of various manus. Vamsa, the dynasties of great kings. Vamsa Anucharita, the activities of such kings. Samstar, annihilation. Hetu, motivation. And Apashraya, the supreme shelter. Other scholars state that the great Puranas, the Mahapuranas, deal with these 10 topics, while lesser Puranas may deal with 5. And he explains, here the word Antarani refers to periods of manus. 61.2. According to some, a Purana has 5 characteristics. This is now from Matsya Purana, actually. And we already noted this in the first couple of weeks of our course. The 5 characteristics of a Purana are Sarga, creation, Pratisarga, annihilation, Vamsa, genealogy, Manvantarani, the reign of Manus, and Vamsa Anucharitam, the activities of dynasties of kings and successions of saints. That is exactly the list which we got earlier. Well, it's coming from exactly the same source, so it's there. This difference of opinion is due to the different topics that characterize greater and lesser Puranas. Although Puranas such as the Vishnu Purana discuss all 10 topics, these Puranas are considered lesser because they discuss only 5 of the topics in depth. These 5. Actually, they do discuss all 10, but the other 5 are only briefly discussed, and actually they are discussed in the context of these 5. And in fact, we will now tell you, although it will not come up in the test, we will tell you how they group them. Under Sarga, in a regular Purana, under Sarga, creation, comes the Mahapuranas, Sarga, Visarga, and Ashraya. In a lesser Purana, a regular Purana, then when it talks about Sarga, it is talking about Sarga, Visarga, and Ashraya. But more Sarga. And Visarga and Ashraya, they're featuring less prominently. And within that context of creation. Pratisarga, the annihilation. Then, in terms of the topics of a Mahapurana, that is including Nirodha, of course, means annihilation, and Mukti. Mukti is also discussed in the context of annihilation, but as a lesser aspect of annihilation than the regular annihilation of the whole universe being wiped out like that. Then Vamsa, genealogy, discusses Ishanu Kata, about the dynasties of the great kings, about the appearances of the Lord, the appearances of the Lord in the families of kings. In that sense, it's genealogically related. Then Manvantara, the reign of Manus, that includes Manvantara and Stanam, maintenance. Maintenance is discussed, but as a type of function of the Manus, secondary to the general story of the Manus in general. then Vangs Anucharita, in a regular Purana, the reign of kings, includes Ishanu Kata, the law about the dynasties of the great kings, or, well, no, about the appearances of the Lord, the appearances of the Lord in the families of kings. In that sense, it's genealogically related. Then Manvantara, the reign of Manus, that includes Manvantara and Stanam, maintenance. Maintenance is discussed, but as a type of function of the Manus, secondary to the general story of the Manus in general. Then Vangs Anucharita, in a regular Purana, the reign of kings, includes Ishanu Kata, the Lord is appearing in dynasties of kings. Poshana, the protection of devotees. Uti, material desire, and Ashraya. That's just for your interest. We're not going to ask you about that in the test. They're overlapping. In some cases, they're overlapping. Yeah. Because they can be applied. Ashraya can be applied in terms of the Lord's function as the original creator. He is the Ashraya of the living entities, of the material elements. And also in terms of Vangs Anucharita, the Lord is appearing in the reigns of kings to give Ashraya, but it tends to be secondary to the reigns of the kings and sort of the historical elements of the narrations. Question is, why do Sutta and Shukadeva give different lists? We'll be seeing that they're not different. They are causing some different names, but they are meaning the same things. No, it has their touches there. That's why Shukadeva is so important, because of his touch. Yeah. So, but don't worry, it's not a big thing. It's not a big thing. So, there are other Mahapuranas. Yeah. But those which are not Mahapuranas, then they do discuss them all, as I've just said. But the other ones, the other five, appear as secondary aspects of the five which a regular Purana is focusing on. So now, let us go on to 61.3. This is very interesting now. 61.3 to the end of 61. It's very interesting. In Srimad Bhagavatam, there is no intention of discussing the 10 topics consecutively, one per canto. After all, the Bhagavatam has 12 cantos. So, you know, what would the implications be that two cantos have no position or something? Nor should one think that because the 10 topics are listed in the second canto, right, that we read about yesterday, Shukadeva, he listed them out, that therefore they could be found one after another from canto 3 to 12. Because there's 10 cantos there. Like the two first cantos are introductory somehow, and not really dealing with the 10 topics. But then from 3 to 12, they may be dealing with the 10, either consecutively or not. So because three topics of Nirodha, Mukti, and Ashraya can all be found in the 10th, 11th, and 12th cantos. Nor will one find the remaining topics in order in the other cantos, with the exception of the 8th canto. Which would be the 6th.
if you start at 2. And that would mean that in the 6th canto, you do find Manvantara is focused on very much. Okay. But other things are also, like protection by the Lord. Lord Vamana appears to give protection to Indra, his devotee. So protection is there also, even though Manvantara is quite prominent in the 8th canto, but it's not the only subject there. 61.4. Srila Sridhar Swami also indicates this, the absence of a strict correspondence between the Bhagavatam's topics and cantos. He says, to spread Lord Krishna's glories, the 10th canto describes how unrighteous rulers suffered annihilation, and he uses the word Nirodha. So in other words, in the 10th canto you find Nirodha. So they suffered their annihilation because they deviated from religious principles. But obviously the 10th canto is also talking about Ashraya, about Krishna. So the four types of annihilations of the total material nature were already described earlier in the Bhagavatam. So here, Sridhar Swami's intention is to show that the 10th canto primarily discusses the Ashraya, the form of Sri Krishna. As Sridhar Swami himself states, the subject of the 10th canto is the 10th topic, the Supreme Lord, who shelters his dependent devotees. We can draw similar conclusions about the other cantos. So that Nirodha then, in the 10th canto, all the demons being killed, so many of them, Nirodha. But actually it's all to serve the glorification of the Ashraya that we talked about yesterday, how these other 9 are there simply to glorify, explain about, elucidate about the 10th. So here we have a very clear example of Nirodha in the 10th canto. 61.5. Thus, Sridhar Swami would agree with us that virtually every canto touches on all 10 topics, either directly or indirectly. It is in the same light that we should understand the statement that these topics are described here either directly or indirectly. Now, if you remember, that was Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10.2. We read that yesterday. We noted that point yesterday. In all different ways, in different ways, the 10th topic is being addressed by the other topics like that. Since we actually do find these topics discussed both directly and indirectly throughout the Bhagavatam. And for the same reason, we should recognize that the first and second cantos also belong to this Mahapurana, because they also include the 10 topics very clearly and very wonderfully, like Queen Kunti's prayers in the first canto. Such amazing prayers, very glorious prayers, glorifying Krishna as the Ashraya. So, in the same way, we should understand that the first and second cantos, they're definitely part of Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, we do not accept the idea that these topics are discussed in a strict sequence. Okay, so how's that? That's interesting, isn't it? I found that very interesting. And it's sort of self-evident, really, if you just think about it, and if you read the Bhagavatam, you'll just see that it is happening like that. Sometimes it's more clear, like in the 10th canto, it's just Krishna all the way. In the 8th canto, the Manus and their families are being focused on quite a lot. But, so those are some examples where, you know, one is particularly predominant. But otherwise, on the whole, they're all kind of mixed in together. And they're always just pointing to Krishna They're always doing that in so many ways, directly and indirectly. Well, that is, yes, Srila Jiva Goswami is not just trying to bewilder us here by producing a doubt that we may never have occurred to us. But the thing is, in those days, there were people who were saying that. Yeah. Sorry? That mobile living beings generally thrive on immobile ones. But the word cha and in this verse hints that when the desire impels them, moving creatures will also subsist on other moving creatures. For human beings, however, the means of livelihood is prescribed according to their individual natures on the basis of either selfish desire or scriptural injunction. All this is called vritti. This is basically just clarifying the verse. 62.4. In each age, the infallible Lord appears in this world among the animals, human beings, sages, and demigods. By his activities in these incarnations, he protects the universe and kills the enemies of Vedic culture. This is called raksha. So, it's exactly the same idea as, what is it, poshana. Yeah. Here the word yai, by them, means by the incarnations. This definition of protection, raksha, also incorporates the three topics: Isha Kata, narrations about the Supreme Lord, Stana, maintenance, and Poshana, nourishment. Well, so, same thing. He's just addressing the same things, but just in different ways. And it's just like, in a sense, different commentators on the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. It's kind of like that. 62.5. In each reign of Manu, Manvantara, six types of personalities appear as manifestations of Lord Hari. The ruling Manu, the chief demigods, the sons of Manu, Indra, the great sages, and the partial incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Jiva Goswami says, from the mention here of the activities of the Manus and the others, it is understood that the topic of Sadharma, progressive religious principles, is also covered. In this way, this list of 10 topics is equivalent to the one given earlier in the Bhagavatam. Now, Sadharma was an aspect of something. Where was it? Here it is. It's in 57.2. Manvantara. Sadharma. Establishing transcendental religion was included under Manvantara. It's an aspect of Manvantara. But here it's being included. Well, it's also being included. Same thing, yeah. Okay. So even without discussing all 10 topics, he's only discussed a few of them. But we can see how Sutta is addressing the same list of 10. Then, dynasties, vamsa, are lines of kings originating with Lord Brahma and extending continuously through past, present, and future. The accounts of such dynasties, especially of their most prominent members, constitute the subject of dynastic history. So, therefore, Jiva Goswami says, the activities of the vamsa dhara, the prominent members of those dynasties, constitutes vamsa anucharitam. So as we say here in the commentary number 2, even though his list appears different in some respects at least from Shukadev's, it's not different. It's the same list. So then he goes on to discuss some the balance. See, already without discussing all 10, he has mentioned at least quite a few of the 10, more than he has actually given from his list. I mean, in terms of Shukadev's list. So now he's going to cover the balance. And this is the last verse, devotees. This is it. This is the end of Tattva Sandhava. There are 4 types of cosmic annihilations. occasional, elemental, continuous, and ultimate, all of which are affected by the inherent potency of the Supreme Lord. Learned scholars have designated this topic dissolution, samsta, or Nirodha, we would say, from Shukadeva. Now, these, you have to know what these four types are, okay? For the tense at the end of the day of Brahma. Elemental, well, the Sanskrit is prakritik, prakritika. It means the end of Brahma's life. It means complete, really. Elemental or complete. Elemental in the sense that all the elements are dissolved again. You know, it all goes back to pradhan. Are you with us? Occasional means the annihilation at the end of Brahma's day. Elemental or complete means at the end of Brahma's life. Continuous, this is an interesting one. There is continuous annihilation. It means the aging process. The general tendency of all material things to deteriorate over a period of time. Number three, continue. We're in 63.1. Okay. And we're now with the third of the four types of annihilations. Continuous means the way time acts, or the result of time acting on all material things. Everything material is continually going through a process of annihilation. And ultimate means liberation. Liberation here is being considered a type of annihilation, because, you know, not only is your material body annihilated, but your whole material life is annihilated. Elemental can also be called complete, and that means the annihilation at the end of the life of Brahma, when the whole material creation goes back to pradhan. So in this way, mukti, as we wrote on the board, mukti, number 9 from Shukadeva, is a part of samsta, number 8, from Sutta. Because Sutta has not mentioned mukti directly as one of the 10, does not mean he has missed it out. It's there. But in the context of samsta, or annihilation, number 8, from Sutta. Jiva Goswami says, in this verse, the word asya, his, refers to the Parameshwar, the Supreme Lord, while swabhavata, due to nature, means by his energy. The term atyantika, ultimate, implies that mukti, or liberation, is included in this kind of dissolution. 63.2. Now he's going to talk about hetu directly, uti. It's already been included in one of the others to some extent, but now he's going to talk about it directly in the next verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, 12.7.18. Sutta says, out of ignorance, the living being performs material activities and therefore becomes in one sense the cause, or hetu, of the creation, or uti, you could say, of the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe. If there were no stupid, conditioned souls like us, you wouldn't need a stupid material world. No. One time, there's a conversation. One person is asking Prabhupada, what's going to happen, though, if everyone takes to Krishna consciousness and goes back to Godhead? What'll happen to the human race? Prabhupada said, yes, this is our goal. No more human race. This is our goal. Yes. no more universe, no more material world. Some authorities call the living being the personality underlying the material creation. So here again is a sort of indirect suggestion that the jiva could possibly be the ashraya. This is going to be addressed, though, shortly. While others say he is the unmanifest self, could be the ashraya, perhaps. So, Jiva Goswami says, the hetu, or cause here, is the nimitta, or efficient cause. Asya, of this, refers to this universe, the existence of which is due to the jivas, who act in ignorance. It's not that Krishna, as the primary cause of creation, it's not that he wants a material world for his own personal purposes at all. It's just for the jivas who act in ignorance. Some call that same cause the anushayi, the underlying personality, highlighting the principle of consciousness, while others call him the avyakrita, the unmanifest, focusing attention on the jivas upadis. Because of the upadis, because we're in maya, because we've got upadis, because we're conditioned, limited by our conditioning, therefore the world has been caused. Yeah. But in another sense, in the anushayi sense, the first of the two senses, then because we are living entities and we are capable of animating matter and supplying consciousness within this material world, therefore, on that level also, we could be called the cause. 63.3. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present. So now, you see, now he's introducing the ashraya, but he's going to call them the apashraya. It means basically the same thing. We'll see as we go through this. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present throughout all the states of awareness, waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Again, the point of Pipalayana. Yeah, Pipalayana. Throughout all the phenomena manifested by the external energy and within the functions of all living entities. And he also exists separate from all these. He's underlying within all of them, but he's also separate. So he's really the real ashraya. Thus situated in his own transcendence, he is the ultimate and unique shelter. So then Jiva Goswami comments, it cannot be said that the jiva is the ashraya, even in his pure state. That would go against what Srila Vyasadeva experienced in trance. Rather, the correct understanding is as follows. And now, this is his explanation of 12.7.19, the verse at the beginning of 63.3, which we are reading right now. 63.3 has pointed out, or this 12.7.19, Sudha Goswami has pointed out, how the jiva, even though he might appear to be the ashraya in some sense, he can't really be the ashraya. So the explanation is, based on 12.7.19, the Supreme Brahman is alone in his original identity. He is aloof from the states of consciousness, known as waking awareness and so on, and also from the manifestations of matter, beginning with the Mahatattva. All these are products of the external energy, that is to say, creations of his maya potency. So he's applying the realization of Vyasa again. While remaining aloof from all these manifestations, he simultaneously associates with them in his features the supersoul, the supreme witness. Therefore, he is the basis for the jiva's activities in both his pure and his conditioned state. But in this context, the word apashraya indicates that even while he is the foundation for the jiva's activities, he still remains transcendental to everything. The prefix apa refers to abandonment, which here amounts to the idea of transcending. He's got nothing to do with it. just in case you might have thought that he could have. It doesn't mean that this is a superior concept to simply Ashraya, but there is an element of emphasis by Sutta. 63.4. Such knowledge of the pure nature of the jiva, who is here designated the cause of material existence, leads to realization of the Apashraya, or transcendental fountainhead of existence. As Sutta Goswami states in two verses, which just happen to be the next two verses. So this, of course, is referring to what? 63.2. Where there was some suggestion that the living being is the hetu, either in the sense of being the underlying conscious entity, or because of having his upadis, because he's materially conditioned, therefore he needs a material world. Because someone's a criminal, they need a prison, and the supreme authorities will provide. So in certain senses, like this. So this knowledge then, from 63.2, from this previous verse, a couple of verses back, from Sutta Goswami, about the jiva being designated the cause of material existence, it's not meant to confuse us, it's meant to help us understand the Apashraya, actually. As Sutta Goswami states in the next two verses, although a material object may assume various forms and names, it's meant to confuse us, it's meant to help us understand the Upashraya, actually. As Sutta Goswami states in the next two verses, although a material object may assume various forms and names, its essential ingredient is always present as the basis of its existence. Similarly, both conjointly and separately, the jiva is always present with the created material body throughout its phases of existence, beginning with conception and ending with death. Either on the strength of one's own power of discrimination, or because of one's regulated spiritual practice. Now, he's making here a very important statement. This is actually the concluding statement of the whole book. He's going to explain it further in the next, in 63.5, but here is the statement, concluding statement. So, either on the strength of one's power of discrimination, means either by jnana, or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, either through bhakti yoga, one's mind may stop functioning on the material platform of waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Then the jiva understands the supreme soul and withdraws from material endeavor or goes back to Godhead. Yeah. So now he's going to explain that in 63.5. We can consider the substances, earth, water, and so on, to be either associated with their products having names and forms, such as pots, or separate from them. After all, we can identify these substances even apart from their products. You get the idea? You can see trees, which are wood, or you can see these chairs, which are made of wood. In both cases, you know, oh, here we have some wood. So you can consider these fundamental substances either in association with their products or derivatives like that, or in their more original states. In the same way, although by the force of ignorance, the originally pure spirit soul becomes involved with the nine stages of life, from conception to death, he can nonetheless become indifferent by understanding that he is in fact distinct from all this by virtue of his being a pure self. Thus becoming aloof, he is then qualified to inquire about the Ashraya. That is the purport of the verse beginning Vira Meter, which is the last of the verses we just read. So, the nine stages, again, we're not going to ask you this in the test, but I just thought you might like to know, what are these nine stages? Impregnation. Yes.